Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Ellen Langer, a professor of psychology at Harvard University and the first woman ever to be tenured in psychology at Harvard. Her studies include the illusion of control, decision-making, aging and mindfulness theory, and she has often been described as the mother of mindfulness. She has written many books, including the best-selling Mindfulness, The Power of Mindful Learning, On Becoming an Artist, Reinventing Yourself Through Mindful Creativity, Counterclockwise, Mindful Health and the Power of Possibility, and the Wiley Mindfulness Handbook. And she's going to talk to us today about mindfulness and the power of possibility. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, nice to be here.
Okay, well, could you start, Ellen, just by telling us a little bit about your background and what it was that prompted you to originally choose this field of work?
Well, looking back over all these years, it's really hard to know what started it, but I've told a particular story so many times that I'm starting to believe it's real. So basically, there are a few things. The first is when I was dealing with my grandmother when I was in graduate school, and she had been labeled as senile. They didn't have notions of dementia then. And she complained of a snake in her head. And I recognized that what she was saying was that her head hurt as if there was a snake in it.
Yeah.
But because that was such a strange way of speaking, she was called basically crazy. You know, when you're old and crazy, you're demented or senile.
Yeah.
And so by paying some attention to all the mistakes I thought that the medical world was making, that started me thinking about how everybody's behavior can be understood in multiple ways and how we tend to only understand it a single way and the troubles that could get us into. A short while after I moved from New York to Cambridge to start teaching at Harvard, and the stereotype that I had of Cambridge was all of these smart people walking around. And what I found was because it was so different from New York, you know, there was a certain, we'll say, street smart that the people here didn't seem to have. So there were things that took place that also gave me cause to pause. In New York, for example, when the banks used to close at 3 o'clock, and so that meant that all the parking spaces were going to be fine at the bank. In New York, you wouldn't be able at 3:01 to get one of these parking spaces. Here, they were just waiting to be used. So there was something different that was going on. Not infrequently, if shopping, I would walk into a mannequin and I would excuse myself asking for, you know, making an apology to this mannequin rather than a person. And the more of us you do, the more you look around and see how everybody else is doing this, how people are driving along and they're expecting to get off at one exit and they don't realize they passed it 20 minutes ago. And then I noticed that we also have the expression, the light's on, but nobody's home. So there's some way that people acknowledge that there's something else that's happening, that people are simply not fully present. And so these thoughts started to coalesce and just grow. I mean, over the last 40 years, with study after study, I've become persuaded that virtually all of us are mindless almost all the time.
Yeah, and well, could you explain what in more depth what you mean by mindlessness?
Yes, yeah? Sure. When people are mindless, the past is overdetermining the present. We're trapped in a rigid perspective, acting like automatons, and we're oblivious to it. Basically, our behavior is governed by rules and routines rather than being in the present.
Yeah.
When you're mindful, as we study it, it's very simple. It's the act of noticing more things, when you notice new things, rather. Noticing new things puts you in the present, makes you sensitive to context and perspective. It suggests when you're mindful that you can have rules and routines, but but they should guide rather than govern what you're doing. And this act of simply noticing new things is the essence of engagement. So while you're noticing new things, the neurons are firing, and our research shows that it's literally and figuratively enlivening.
Yeah. And am I right in saying you started studying mindlessness from a Western scientific perspective?
Yes, yeah, and I started this in the early 70s.
Yeah, and this was before the whole mindfulness revolution arose.
Yes, I think so.
Okay, but then...
And hopefully I was part of bringing it about.
Now, the mindfulness you espouse, you call direct mindfulness. How does this differ from the mindfulness that we associate more with meditation, for example?
Well, meditation is a tool. And it's a tool to lead to post-meditative mindfulness.
Uh-huh.
The mindfulness that we study is more direct. Both are good for you, and they're not mutually exclusive. So if you were to meditate, you sit back, close your eyes, repeat a mantra, and periodically thoughts will come,
yeah.
And you're supposed to then let the thought just pass and go back to the mantra,
yeah.
Which is essentially saying that the thought is unreal. It's not important. In our scheme of things, when you have a thought, you can actively engage the thought, ask yourself questions about whether it's true, it's not true, how it might be good, how it might be bad, how other people might see it, how it changes over time. And all of these release the power of the thought over you.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm just thinking, the chair of our society, Robert Ellis, in a recent review of one of your books, said in relation to this, what he found exciting about your idea of mindfulness is that it goes beyond the type, say, Buddhism espouses, which is often presented either as something that will naturally be developed through meditation practice, or as something that can be developed through awareness of one's body, mind, others, and context. However, the problem with such awareness is that it is difficult to reconcile with the normal cognitive preoccupations of most people's minds. It seems to unrealistically demand that we enter into a separate, refined aesthetic zone during everyday life. Now, your approach, on the other hand, uses and channels our cognitive preoccupations. We do not need to stop thinking in any sense, but rather think in habitually,
right.
Yeah, in habitually more open and creative ways to enjoy life more and reduce stress, conflict, and alienation. So as you say, it's not about excluding meditation as a helpful practice. It's just you focus more instead on all the more cognitively focused ways we can improve our ability to address. Yeah.
And that's a good summary. But it's also the case that mindfulness, as we study it, is not just a cognitive process.
Yeah.
So it's kinesthetic, you know, touch, taste, vision, hearing, that most of us don't see what's right in front of us when we think we know.
Sure, yeah.
We can fine-tune and see things in more vividly. People think, for instance, trees are green. Well, there are 1,000 different shades of green. So if we simply notice, what happens is the tree figuratively comes alive for us. When we're touching something, we act as if it's all one feeling, and of course that varies. So the bottom line, or one of the bottom lines, is that we tend to hold the world still and confuse the stability of our mindsets, our thoughts about the world, whether it's touch, taste, vision, thought. We hold that mindset still, although the world is changing. And so what we want to do is be more comfortable, learn to be more comfortable with uncertainty. And then what happens when you're mindful, you're in the present. You know, lots of people say be in the moment, but it's typically an empty instruction, because when you're not there, you're not there to know you're not there. When you're actively noticing new things, that puts you in the present. And it's enlivening, it's energy begetting. And when you're in the present, then you get to take advantage of opportunities to which you'd otherwise be blind, and you get to avoid the pitfalls before you become vulnerable to them.
So rather than thinking in absolute terms, we're somewhere in this messy, as you say, uncertain bit in between. But is it also important to distinguish between what you call universal uncertainty and personal uncertainty?
Barry, thank you so much for mentioning that. That's very important, because most people shudder at the thought of uncertainty. It's very scary. You know, that's why lots of people think the devil I know is better than the devil I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, so don't take a chance, don't make changes. And that's because they're assuming that, you know, let's say you're in a relationship that's awful, that's the devil you know, and you're afraid to get out of it because of all the uncertainty that would ensue. The mistake there, the mindlessness there, is assuming that that relationship is going to stay just as it is.
Uh-huh.
Whether it could get worse, could get better, who knows. But things are always changing. Now, for most of us, we tend to make what I call a personal attribution for uncertainty, which means I don't know, but you may know, so therefore I'll pretend that I know, I'll hide the fact that I don't know. And I'm suggesting that what is more adaptive and closer to the truth in some sense is to make a universal attribution for uncertainty. And what that is I don't know, you don't know, nobody knows.
Yeah.
And we can't know because things are always changing and look different from different perspectives. So then you can be confident and uncertain. You know, the uncertainty is there. If you don't want to pay attention to it, you're going to be victimized by it one way or the other. Pretending it's not there doesn't make it go away.
Sure, but just because we're uncertain about things, it doesn't mean to say we can't be decisive either, presumably.
No, not only that, but if we were certain about everything, we'd be living our lives like painting by numbers.
Yeah.
There'd be nothing exciting.
Exactly.
What makes life exciting is the journey, the adventure, not knowing exactly what's ahead, but knowing that whatever is ahead, you can handle it. And then we get back to a realization that outcomes are neither good nor bad. What's good or bad are the views we take of them. So when we open up our views and we recognize that even things that seem bad have a part to them that are actually good, we don't fear them as much.
And then this sensibility that we're talking about, this openness to or power of possibility, is more about thinking, as you say, how can rather than can. Could you expand on that
exactly.
a bit?
Yeah. Many people assume that the disease they have can't be ameliorated, controlled. They believe that they're a task that they simply can't do. There are a lot of people who place limits on themselves when there's no data that one could access to actually prove that point. You can never prove that you can't. All you can say is that what you tried didn't work. And so I suggest people change this notion of I can't to, or it's uncontrollable, to seeing things as indeterminate, which means there may be a way to conquer this. And since the journey is what's important, as we just said, then if you try it this way and it doesn't work, then you try it another way, because it's that journey that makes the whole thing fun.
Yeah.
It's, you know, people think that all they want is successes, and if that were the case, I suggest that they play tic-tac-toe with a five-year-old, you know, who doesn't yet know the rule of the game. You'll always win. And I can't imagine that's a life that anybody would want. So people have to recognize that this uncertainty, these little surprises, are actually very motivating for us. And they make life exciting. We don't want to get rid of it.
We do live in a world, though, where it's geared to a fear of mistakes. I'm just thinking of something in the news today in the UK where a politician here has made a U-turn and he's just getting torn to pieces by the press because he's gone back on some better evidence has come along to change his view and he's getting slammed for it.
Yeah, well, that's a shame because mistakes are mistakes only in particular contexts. You change the context and the mistake may be a strong advantage. So an example I'm fond of using is a company was trying to make a glue and I guess they made all sorts of mistakes because the glue failed to adhere.
Yeah.
And that would seem something worthy of a great deal of stress, disappointment, criticism, all these negative things. However, it was 3M, and 3M thought to use that glue that failed to adhere and make a Post-it note out of it. So the essence of the Post-it note is its failure to adhere.
Brilliant.
So was it a success or a failure? Well, it was a failed glue. It was a successful Post-it note. They were too quick to judge. Any mistake can be an opportunity, can be a success if we look for a different context. And even if we keep the context still, a mistake today, with everything being more or less the same over time, may turn out to be a success.
So how do we go about being, you know, from a practical perspective, how do we go about being directly mindful in everyday situations, such as in our normal daily interactions with people, our daily chores, etc.?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing we have to do is put away all of the certainties we have.
Okay.
About what's going to happen, how people are, all the dispositions we accuse people of having, you know, you're selfish, you're stubborn, you're rigid, and so on, and recognize that people are always changing, and somebody who's rigid is only rigid some of the time, and importantly, that behavior makes sense from the actor's perspective, or else the actor wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So when this person, from your perspective, is being rigid, what are they from their perspective? Well, they're probably being stable, consistent, someone you can count on,
yeah,
which is actually a good thing. So when we see that all of our evaluations of anything can be turned around, as soon as we're dealing with negativity, since negative, positive, they're both in our heads rather than the world around us, why not just turn it around? And that's a mindful exercise. Everything you think you know, ask how it could be wrong. When I lecture on these things, I often ask people how much is one in one. And everybody thinks they know the answer is two, but it's not always two. If you were to add 1 watt of chewing gum to 1 watt of chewing gum, 1 plus 1 is 1.
Yeah.
So when we see even the things we think we know best are not always the case, when you know that you can't be sure, then you naturally stay tuned in. So we need to increase our appreciation for uncertainty. If we take the things that we think we know, let's say the people that we know, and we just find 5 new things about them next time we interact with them, they'll come alive for us again. And we do this 5 new things about the walk you take to your house, and so on. We think we know, and that's the illusion.
So, for example, if you really didn't like watching football, you'd become interested by looking at the interactions between the players, and then they...
Right, exactly. Well, we did research on that where we took people who didn't like football, other people who didn't like classical music, those who didn't like rap music, those who didn't like art. And in each case, we just had them do the activity. Another group was asked to notice one new thing about it. Another group was asked, notice 3 new things about it. And the last group for each of these activities was asked to notice 6 new things about it. And what we found is that the more you notice, the more you like the thing you're noticing. So there are people who wait on the sidelines for something to appeal to them. This is a much more active approach. As soon as you engage the world, you notice things about it, you're going to like it. So I think that possibly one exercise that hadn't occurred to me before right now is to get people to engage activities they think they don't like,
mm-hmm,
and make it new for themselves, find things about it. You know, if you have people, women who don't like football, and they're watching the football players and just noticing their rear ends, it doesn't matter what you notice, as long as it's new for you, it will draw you into the activity.
Okay. Now, there are many spheres where this could have obvious implications beyond our everyday lives. Now, as an ex-teacher, I found the work you've done on education really interesting. For example, you say in your book, The Power of Mindful Learning, that mindlessness not only disrupts the learning process itself, but also at the same time reduces motivation. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that most of us are taught facts as absolutes. And when you're taught something as an absolute, if you learn it as an absolute, it doesn't occur to you to use that information in any novel way. And it also becomes uninteresting. And the reality, as we just said, with one and one is two, is not always two, is that all of these facts are only true from particular perspectives. So if facts were taught in what I call a conditional way, maybe it would seem that it could be from one perspective, said before the so-called facts, people would learn them mindfully, and they would stay interesting. You know, when you say, I'm trying to think of some battle between the United States and England to make it interesting, but my knowledge of history is not good enough to go there. But when we're given historical facts, we're typically given them as perspective free. Well, somebody decided, one, that that was a fact, two, that the way they're describing it is the way that it was. Somebody different might describe it quite differently, you know, and so on. And if you knew that it was from a particular perspective, then it becomes interesting to ask, how would it look from yet another person's perspective? You know, if you were looking at a cow and you were a Hindu, you would see it very differently from if you were a cattle rancher, which would be very different if you were a biochemist or if you were somebody who hadn't eaten and who was a carnivore and hadn't eaten in quite some time. You know, it's the same stimulus, but looked at differently. You see it in different ways. And when we're taught to see it only one way, we give up the richness of the world around us. I think education, and I say this in a few months, the revision to the Power of Mindful Learning will be out. And there I come clean and say that I believe our system of education across the world is probably the culprit in having taught all of us to be so mindless.
Interesting, yeah.
It's taught us to be evaluative. It's taught us that there are winners and losers. It's mistakenly led us to believe that there's not enough to go around for all of us. And it's led us to believe that facts exist in some independent of human thought way, which they don't.
Well, I don't know about the States, Ellen, but certainly in the UK, education seems to be even more rigid, and that the children have to jump through more and more hoops and just rather than being open and explorative and learning in more open conditional ways.
Right. And what I'm saying is that the teachers don't know. They think they know, but they don't know. And so imagine you had a teacher of young children and she asked, how much is one in one? And one of the students, these young people, says one. That person is going to be possibly harmed for life. The teacher is going to look at the student as if he or she is a moron. Perhaps it's a little strong. They may even try to hide that, but it will seep out. Other people will look at the child that way. Where in this mindful environment that I'm trying to nurture, what when you realize people's behavior makes sense or else they wouldn't do it, the teacher would say, Janie or Johnny, how did you come to that? And then the child would explain, and then everybody would have learned something.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the medicalization of ADHD in relation to this?
Yeah, well, I think that I have lots of thoughts. I usually watch myself when I'm talking about the medical world and begin my comments with, I have great respect. These are people who are typically smart and very caring. But much of what the medical world tells us, I think, is simply wrong. Mm-hmm. So lots of my research is about reversing some of these mindsets. I think that most diseases can be handled and can be handled psychologically, and that's some of the work that we're doing. You know, in its earliest years, what we did was make people more mindful and found that they live longer. And now we're addressing many specific diseases, ALS, MS, arthritis, diabetes, with wonderful early results. I think that with respect to ADHD, I think it's greatly overdiagnosed. I think part of the problem with ADHD is that most people, have a mistaken idea about how to pay attention. People think, we gave questionnaires to, 1,000 or so teachers and asked them, when you tell your students, pay attention, focus, concentrate, what are you telling them? And then the answers included, hold the image still as if you're looking through a camera. And that's what everybody circled. Everybody thinks that when you're trying to pay attention or focus, concentrate on something, you hold the image still. But the image doesn't want to stay still, and that's not the way you pay attention. The way you pay attention to something is noticing things about it, not keeping it still. So we took people who had been diagnosed with ADHD, the elderly who were supposed to have trouble paying attention, and then we even added Harvard students because they're supposed to be so good they don't need any help. And we had one group where they're told, pay attention, focus, concentrate, and and then the important group, the mindful group, was told to notice new things about the stimuli they were presented with. And across the board, everybody did better. Everybody was able to pay attention when they were paying attention in this more reasonable way. So oddly, I think some of the kids who are diagnosed with an attention deficit disorder are just doing what the teacher has told them to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think something else that I believe strongly, when I say behavior makes sense from the actor's perspective or else the actor wouldn't do it, that when the child is not paying attention to the teacher, there may be some good reason for it. There may be something the child is attending to that's simply more interesting. And I think we have a rule in our cultures, if I have the power, you have the problem. You know, so I'm teaching, if you're not finding what I'm saying interesting, that's because you have some disorder, you know, rather than perhaps I should try to up my game and be more interesting to you. And then the last piece on this is that once we medicalize everything and you tell somebody they have a disorder, if you tell someone you have an attention disorder, every task requires attention, so people are going to opt out from most things. And if you're opting out, you know, if you think, for instance, you have a reading disability, so you don't read, over time, all the people who are reading are going to know a lot more than you are, and it's just going to snowball. And then it becomes a real deficit.
And it just spirals, yeah. So you talked a little bit earlier about some of the experiments that you've done. Could we just focus on a couple? Like, for example, in the book on The Powerful Mindful Learning, you talk about the importance of turning work into play. Now, there was one particular experiment with chambermaids that seemed to exemplify this.
Yeah, that was the chambermaids was written about in the Counterclockwise book.
Okay.
And this is interesting. It's interesting to me also that you relate the two. I don't know if we're going to have enough time for me to discuss that, but let me just tell you about the chambermaid study. So the chambermaid study was derived from what we call the mind-body unity theory.
Okay.
It's a very simple idea that, you know, right now there's what is called the mind-body problem. That's essentially how do you get from this fuzzy thing called a thought to something material called the body? And I say, okay, let's put the mind and body back together so they're one. And if they're one, then that question, how do you get from one to the other, goes away. So then we put the mind in all sorts of strange places and take measurements from the body. The first one of these was the counterclockwise study, where I took old men to a timeless retreat that had been retrofitted to 20 years earlier and had them talk about the past in the present tense. They were living as if it was 20 years earlier. And as a result, their vision improved, their hearing improved, their strength, their memory, and they also looked younger. And I think, although people in the States can't see this, this was replicated by the BBC in a program called The Young Ones. And you might still be able to get it on the Internet.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the same idea was done with the chambermaids. We took chambermaids, and the first thing we did was to ask them how much exercise they get. And oddly, since they're exercising all day long, they don't see themselves as exercising because they think exercise is, the Surgeon General tells us, what you do after work. Okay, so all we're going to do is take these women and teach half of them that their work is exercise. Making a bed is likened to this or that machine at the gym and so on. So now we have two groups. One group that sees their work as exercise, one group that doesn't have that thought. We take a lot of measures. We go away. We come back. I don't remember if it was a month or 6 weeks later. And first thing we want to know, are they behaving any differently? So Are the women who now see their work as exercise working harder? The answer seems to be no. Are they eating any differently? The answer seems to be no. So they seem on all those measures to still be the same two groups. Then we take our important measures. What we find is this group that now changed their mindset, simply changing their minds to believe that their work is exercise, lost weight, there was a change in waist-to-hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure came down. All from the change in mindset.
Amazing. I have to say, Ellen, it's really exciting for us in the society to have come across your work, which has only been recent, to be honest, because all the key components of the middle way, as we understand it, appears to be present in your use of mindfulness, which we would term provisionality, conditionality, which is compatible with what we call incrementality. And then there's this recognition of absolutes as unhelpful dogmas. There's embodiment and an insistence on moving beyond the socially sanctioned achievements of scientific justification to engage with individual experience. So there
are a lot of similarities, and that's wonderful. I think that something that I've used the work for, and I suggest people who are knee-deep in your version of it, start asking, what are the limits that people have taken as real that we can open up and attack, as I and my students are now doing with some of these dread diseases?
Yeah, no, well, that's really, really good advice, Ellen. Just one maybe related thing to this. The middle way is often, we feel, misunderstood as some wishy-washy compromise. Now, what is your view on compromise?
Well, actually, I think compromise is mindless.
Yeah.
Compromise means everybody's agreeing to lose, just to lose less. And I think that for most situations, there's a win-win solution available if you didn't mindlessly jump to compromise. But the similarity between being provisional, being conditional, both of those leading to mindfulness, I think is very real. It's very empowering for those who are willing to think some about it. I think that in the past, people who were conditional, who would say, I'm not sure, maybe, could be, were seen as weak. And because they were persuaded that they were weak, they said these provisional words in a non-confident way.
Yeah.
But once you recognize that that's the more mindful stance, because everything is changing, that certainty is mindless, that you can be provisional and confident. And then I think that once you start pointing out to people the exceptions to the things they think are true, they'll come around.
Okay.
And when they think that there are things that one can't do, they may stay stuck in that until we show them that it can be done. We're now trying to, we've got some data with ALS. It's very early on. We find that people who have ALS, who are more mindful, fare better. Now soon we're going to be teaching them to be more mindful, and hopefully the results will be straightforward and we can just sort of put it out there in the world. We have people who have multiple sclerosis who we make more mindful, who do better. People with arthritis and so on. We have one of these counterclockwise studies with diabetes that's sort of extraordinary, where what we find is we have people come in for a study. They're playing a video game. In the lower right-hand corner of the screen is a clock. For a third of the people, the clock is running twice as fast as real. For a third of the people, it's running half as fast as real. For a third of the people, it's accurate. And the question we're asking is, does blood sugar level follow real or perceived time? And the answer is it seems to follow perceived time, which means that we may be able to cure diabetes through psychological means in the not too distant future. You know, not within the next couple of years, but certainly in the foreseeable future. And I think that that's what we're going to find with most diseases. And the only way you're going to be able to come to those even to ask the questions that we ask here, is to have a more provisional understanding of everything we think we know.
How fascinating.
That we right now we think that there are limits that are based on the notion that nobody has done more than it. And that's not a good reason to think that we can't do more. I ask my students, how far is it humanly possible to run? And because the marathon is, 26 miles, they say 26, 32, somewhere around there. And then I tell them of a tribe in Mexico, the Tarahumara, who are able to run 200 miles without stopping.
Wow.
And if you can run 200, why can't you run 220? And so on. So anyway, so it's going to be a brighter future.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's... That's brilliant. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Ellen, and absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.